Now, closing arguments are wrapping up today in the case against Kyle Rittenhouse, the Illinois teenager charged with shooting three people and killing two of them during protests in Kenosha last year. The jury's tasked to determine whether he acted lawfully in self-defense. The judge in the case dismissed a misdemeanor charge against Rittenhouse earlier today. He will allow the jury to consider lesser charges in their verdicts on the remaining counts. We are recapping the prosecution and defense arguments and getting a better understanding of the jury's responsibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about the different charges against Rittenhouse or what you've seen or heard about the trial as it's been going on, what do you think of the argument that he was or wasn't acting in self-defense? Do you think Wisconsin law needs to change in any way based on what you've heard about the case? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. John, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This is a case, obviously, that's gotten attention around the state, around the country. In a courtroom, how insulated can people really be from that knowledge of the wider interest in that case?
Well, I don't think it would be possible to have been in Kenosha for the last year and not have heard something about the case, or really in all of Wisconsin, maybe even the country, because of the level of publicity that it's received. The challenge really for the jurors as they're being selected is to really ask themselves, despite what they may have heard about the case, do they still have an open mind? Can they weigh the evidence that's presented during the trial and come to a verdict that has not been pre-decided?
You've looked, I know, at the jury selection process. How careful are both sides, prosecutor and defense, to try to make sure that they don't get someone who already has their mind made up on the opposite side?
The real focus for them is to we often say when picking a jury, it's not so much who you're picking to be on the jury. It's the folks that you're trying to remove from the jury. You're deselecting people to serve on the jury because you fear that they may be biased or prejudiced or they may have prejudged the case. And so those are the folks you're trying to kind of weed out. And then you're left with the folks that you hope do have an open mind and can listen to both sides and will judge the case based on the evidence that's presented in the courtroom and not what they've heard about the case through different media sources.
As you look at the different charges, a handful still remaining after the dismissal of that misdemeanor firearms charge, what kind of things are you looking at with what the jury has to decide on based on what both sides have shown them? What kind of standards are required for a guilty verdict on these charges?
Well, the jury always has to be satisfied with any of the charges that the prosecution has proven each element of the case beyond a reasonable doubt. From the defense perspective, I think the defense will be making a fairly straightforward argument to the jury that Mr. Rittenhouse was acting in self-defense, that he was acting reasonably in self-defense that evening. And if the jury believes that, or at the very least, if they do not think that the prosecution has been able to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was acting in self-defense, then he should be acquitted of the remaining charges. The prosecution has a couple of different theories behind how they've charged the case. In one instance, the first person who was shot that night, Mr. Rosenbaum, the prosecution has charged Mr. Rittenhouse with first-degree reckless homicide, which requires that they show utter disregard for human life, that Mr. Rittenhouse acted with utter disregard for human life. But with the other shooting that followed of Mr. Huber, they've charged first-degree intentional homicide so that they need to show that Mr. Rittenhouse indeed intended to kill and caused his death. And they've also charged attempted first-degree intentional homicide with regard to Mr. Grosskreutz. So again, they have to prove that Mr. Rittenhouse attempted to cause his death intentionally.
The judge has instructed the jury, or will be allowing the jury, I understand, to consider different types, possibly lesser charges than the ones the prosecution originally brought. Is that something we would usually see at this stage in a process?
Yes, you would. In fact, Wisconsin by law has lesser forms of homicide are included in more serious forms of homicide. And usually in a case like this, depending on what witnesses the jury might believe or what theory of the case is being argued to them by the defense or the prosecution, it's normal to sort of present to them a range of options, often lesser included offenses, so that they can decide what level of culpability or responsibility they should assign to the defendant's conduct, if they assign any culpability at all. So another sort of level of difficulty, admittedly, for the jury to sort through, but not unexpected.
Talking to John Gross from the UW Law School, director of the Public Defender Project, looking at the closing days of the Kyle Rittenhouse trials. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been following the trial, what has struck you? What questions do you have about what you've seen and heard there? Do you have thoughts on the argument over self-defense and whether it should apply? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. John, a lot of attention to Judge Bruce Schroeder and his style of running a court. And apparently, according to a lot of court reporters and judges or lawyers who have argued in front of him, this is just his normal kind of court demeanor. Do you have thoughts on what he's done, some of the decisions he's made along the way?
Well, I too have heard the same thing, that this is his the normal way that he runs his courtroom. I would say that, you know, he does permit himself to give quite a bit of, I think, commentary along the way, which is something that is not always so desirable from the judge. He definitely has spent a lot of time engaging with the lawyers, talking about the jury instructions and other aspects of the case, so I sort of wonder if some of these issues couldn't have been parsed out before the trial began, which would have eliminated the need to have quite so much back and forth between the parties and the judge over different evidentiary issues and different rulings regarding the dismissal of a charge and the eventual decision to how to charge the jury and what lesser included offenses to include. But this appears to be par for the course for him.
Spray on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Palmyra. Andrew, hello.
Hi there. I just wanted to call and comment on the DA Binger's closing arguments. He made a lot of statements that were either factually inaccurate or were in conflict with statements that he made earlier in his closing argument. For instance, he made a comment that there was no cars on the lot that night and that Kyle Rittenhouse could have run away. There was no reason for him to be there. He also made the comment that when he was running away down the street, that he could have fired warning shots even after he said that this rifle had, you know, severe or significant power and was very dangerous. He still made the comment he should have fired warning shots. And lastly, he made the comment that Gage Grosskreutz's arm was blown off when he was shot, and that, you can see in the video, is factually inaccurate. I think he couldn't keep his story straight, and I think it's something worth listening to.
Andrew, thanks for the call. John, did you see? Have you seen problems with the prosecutor's case not conforming to the facts, including the video evidence?
Well, whenever parties make closing arguments, they are free to urge to the jury whatever inferences, whatever conclusions they think was warranted by the evidence. The judge has instructed the jury previously that, you know, whatever the lawyers say in closing argument, it is just that. It's argument. And if the juror's recollection of the facts or the evidence is inconsistent with what the lawyer is presenting to them during closing argument, if they think the testimony was different, it's their recollection that controls in the case. And so, you know, also the defense is listening to that argument, and I'm sure if they felt that the prosecution was mischaracterizing evidence or misstating evidence, they could have objected to it. But generally speaking, you know, you have some leeway when you're giving your closing argument to pick and choose the facts that you want to emphasize to the jury. But again, you know, if the jury is listening to that argument and they believe that the lawyer is stretching the truth or misstating the facts or ignoring other relevant, important facts that were testified to, then that could diminish the strength of their closing argument.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project, looking at the Kyle Rittenhouse trial coming to a close today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what you've seen and heard in the courtroom about what qualifies as self-defense in Wisconsin law? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with John Gross. He's director of the Public Defender Project and a clinical associate professor of law at the UW Law School. We're talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and the decision that faces the jury in Kenosha County. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to some of the closing arguments on both sides, especially as it pertains to self-defense. First, here's Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger for the prosecution saying Rittenhouse can't claim self-defense because he argues he created the danger he faced.
When the defendant provokes the incident, he loses the right to self-defense. You cannot claim self-defense against a danger you create. That's critical right here. If you're the one who is threatening others, you lose the right to claim self-defense.
Now here's defense attorney Mark Richards responding to that argument in his closing arguments today.
He has as much right to go there as anybody else in the city of Kenosha and be unmolested by the likes of Joseph Rosenbaum, Kelly, and Joshua Zeminski.
So that argument about provoking the incident, negating the self-defense, how does a jury suss that out?
Yeah, so I think one of the challenges here for the jury and the difference in the narrative that both sides are presenting is that the prosecution is presenting this as if Mr. Rittenhouse's presence there with this AR-15 assault rifle when there was a curfew in place, when he was arguably not legally entitled to have the weapon, and by carrying it openly amongst people who were engaged in civil disobedience, protesting, that in itself was a type of provocation, that he basically created this dangerous situation and that therefore he would be deprived of his right to act in self-defense. The defense is claiming that he had as much right, as they said, as anybody else to be there and that he was not the aggressor. In fact, Mr. Rosenbaum and some other of the people who were out protesting that evening were the ones who were acting aggressively and erratically toward him, that the entire environment was one where it was dangerous, and there were people on both sides acting in ways that sort of caused a heightened level of tension. And so when Mr. Rittenhouse fired, he was doing so in self-defense. He was not the one who had initiated the confrontation between himself and Mr. Rosenbaum.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Yeah, I didn't follow the trial that much, but was he hired by somebody to come up and protect their property? Did he just show up with a high-powered rifle and take that upon himself? I mean, you would think the police wouldn't want people running around that aren't deputized.
Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call. Yes, there was an online campaign to try to bring civilians in, they said, to defend property and people against protesters or rioters if that ensued. Does that matter for the case, the trial, that much, John, why Rittenhouse was there in the first place?
Well, I think the prosecution has certainly made some arguments or tried to cast him in the light as being somebody who was an outsider, right, who came to Kenosha and had no connection to Kenosha, that there was no good reason for him to essentially be there. There was certainly no good reason for him to be there with a rifle. There was some testimony too, I think, about officers, you know, at least handing out water and thanking some of the folks who were there with rifles, who claimed to be defending property. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the jury is not really being asked to decide whether or not it was a good idea for him to be there, or whether or not he somehow was given permission to be there by the police officers. They're really just focused on, in his confrontations with those three people that he shot, was it reasonable at that time for him to use deadly force in self-defense?
Thanks for the call, Jimmy. We'll go to Karen now in Madison. Karen, hello.
Oh, first of all, I have to say concealed carry, open carry, all of that just opened a violence mechanism in this state. And you can see that in the statistics of shootings and the numbers of people buying guns. But I also, and this doesn't have anything to do with the trial, but I know that if this young man had been a person of color and done the same thing, and he would not have been able to walk through all of those police officers and leave, he would have been killed. And I know that for a fact. And we have a long way to go on what real justice is. And it's tragic that this young man did this. It's tragic that people encouraged him to by having hate. And it's tragic that the people died that they didn't need to die.
Karen, thanks a lot for the call. As Karen said, John, that probably won't be an issue or a direct factor in the trial. But do you have thoughts on some of those wider issues Karen raises there, and that certainly people are going to be thinking about when this trial ends, however it ends?
Yeah, I mean, there are several issues here that I think may resonate far beyond whatever the specific verdict is. I mean, one issue is, Wisconsin has both open carry and concealed carry. What is the wisdom of having or permitting open carry or concealed carry when you are at an event that is a protest, right? I mean, why permit both protesters or counter-protesters to go about armed and create a public safety concern in that instance? I mean, a lot of folks are also feel very strongly that, that an acquittal of Mr. Rittenhouse will somehow just highlight racial bias in the system, that because he is a young white man, he is going to be permitted to use deadly force against other people in a way that would never, our system would not have permitted a person of color in the same situation to have behaved in the same way. And this again touches on issues about, police use of force and the perception of our justice system as potentially racially biased. And so there are a lot of concerns with this case. I will say this. I mean, the verdict is not a referendum on any of those things. The verdict is not a referendum on the right to carry a gun. It's not a referendum on the right to protest. It really is. The jury's job is to stay focused on whether or not the prosecution has proven the specific charges against Mr. Rittenhouse beyond a reasonable doubt.
Karen, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller with Pat in Brookfield. Pat, hello.
Hello. Just a question for the professor. I found it somewhat interesting. It seemed like initially the prosecution was trying to prove that these individual interactions, so, 1, 2, and 3, that Kyle Rittenhouse reasonably did not need to defend himself. It didn't reach that level, or he was the aggressor individually in these interactions. As the trial played on with the various testimony, even from the third victim, in addition to all of the video evidence, I'm wondering if they saw this as breaking their case, to where it seems now very recently, and in the closing arguments you heard today, they were talking a lot about provocation and the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse was just there with a gun. that automatically eliminates any self-defense. And I'm wondering if that's their strategy now because they understand that they're going to have a really hard time, or they did have a hard time, or frankly, they weren't able to make the connection to that the fact that he wasn't using reasonable self-defense in these individual interactions.
I gotcha, Pat. We're running short on time, so I'm going to cut you off. But, John, I've heard other people make that case that the prosecution seemed to switch gears in that way.
Yes. I think the prosecution has a real challenge in front of them. I mean, when they called Mr. Grosskreutz, he admitted on cross-examination that Mr. Rittenhouse did not shoot him until he was pointing a gun at him. And that seems to really make the defense's argument for them. And so with the evidence showing what it has showed in this case, I think now the prosecution may have decided that they needed to, as you said, shift gears a little bit and argue more broadly that just Mr. Rittenhouse's presence there, his presence armed in the way that he was, is sufficient provocation that would deny him the right to claim self-defense.
Thanks for that call. And just our last half minute, John, I, of course, won't ask you to predict what a jury will do, but you can leave us with a half minute or so of thoughts on the options before them here.
Well, I will say this. I think they have some difficult decisions to make in this case. One of the things that they will have to decide is even if Mr. Rittenhouse was even if he believed that subjectively that he was entitled to use self-defense, was it reasonable for him to think that? And if they find that, then it's possible that they could convict him of the second degree homicide charge. And frankly, I think that might be the prosecution's best hope for conviction, because there has been enough of a claim of self-defense in this case that I think, did he reasonably think he was entitled to use self-defense, or did he subjectively think so? Yes.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to John Gross from the UW Law School, looking at the Rittenhouse case, closing arguments happening today.